Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. Mr. Aristotle by Ignazio Saloni. If anyone is having trouble with his sweetie and wants to straighten matters out with a well-written letter, he goes to see Mr. Aristotle Caramella. The latter lives somewhere between Newtown and Purgatory, in an unprepossessing street that is always damp and smelly, for the reason that it gets little sun, while the women there have the habit of emptying their household slops in front of their doors. There's no use in seeking an interview with Mr. Aristotle of an evening, since he's always drunk then, nor of a morning, seeing that he naps until 11. It is better to look him up in the afternoon. His house is a one-story affair, boasting neither bricks nor stone by way of floor. As you come in, you catch sight over in one corner of a chain, suspended from a spike, and from this chain there hangs a kettle which is given a washing once a year, on the Saturday before Easter. The fire under the kettle is kindled from corn stalks, and the smoke, after circling about the room, finds its way out the door. In the corner opposite the fire there is a bed, that is to say, a pallet stuffed with corn husks and covered with a red woolen blanket. In the center of the room there's a small table with three little wooden benches standing about. It is here that Mr. Aristotle sees his clients. If Mr. Aristotle has been reduced to living like a beggar, between Newtown and Purgatory, it is all owing to a youthful indiscretion. As a lad, he had received a good education, and had later found work as town clerk and in a lawyer's office. It was Mr. Aristotle's job to make the rounds of the neighboring villages in search of cases for his employer, after which it was up to him to get or invent the right kind of evidence. He accomplished this task zealously and ingeniously, and was duly esteemed by the better class of people as one of justice's humble but valuable servants. In his labors, Mr. Aristotle was assisted by three or four poor devils, who from time to time immemorial had been known as grave diggers, dog shearers, or house-to-house peddlers. But on Tuesday morning, which was court day, they placed themselves at his disposition as possible witnesses. Mr. Aristotle commonly referred to them as the mouthpieces of truth. Those who were taken as witnesses would shave, pare their nails, and learn from Mr. Aristotle what it was they were supposed to say to the judge. They would then go to court and swear, as usual, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, before reciting their lesson. If their testimony happened to conflict with that of witnesses on the other side, they remained unshaken and proceeded to strengthen their case with so fervent an appeal to the wrath of God that the others would almost invariably end by becoming confused and would take back or change the testimony they had previously given. Among these mouthpieces of truth was one Toto, who had specialized in denial, and one Rufino, who had a particular talent for affirmation. If Toto was charged with replying no to a question of the judge, nothing in the world could have made him say yes, and if Rufino had had his orders to respond with a yes, no amount of threats or cajoling could have induced him to change that yes to a no. As the law provides, the witnesses thereupon received a fee of 2.5 lire. In addition to this, the mouthpieces of truth had the price of a drink from Mr. Aristotle. If one stops to think that they never got more than a lira for a funeral, it is not hard to understand why these same mouthpieces of truth should have preferred, on a Tuesday, to serve justice rather than the church. If someone died on a Monday, he accordingly had to wait until Wednesday to be taken to the cemetery. People gradually came to realize this, and as a result they stopped dying on Monday. The short of it is, Mr. Aristotle had every reason to look forward to a comfortable and self-respecting future when sentiment took a hand and he lost it all. It was at business with Faustina the dressmaker. This dressmaker person was attacked one day by a couple of large dogs belonging to the Baron of Piscina. It happened in front of the baronial residence. The Baron was on the balcony at the time, with other young members of the nobility, and it would appear that he set the dogs on Faustina to amuse his guests. Alarmed by her cries and the yelping of the dogs, some of the neighbors came running up, but no one dared to go to Faustina's assistance from fear of offending the Baron. It was only when the Baron went back into the house that she was rescued. It left her lame. No sooner was Faustina able to be up and about that she went to the authorities and lodged a complaint against the Baron. Everything possible was done to get her to withdraw it, but she refused to listen to reason. "I want justice," was her answer. Now, among those who had witnessed the scene in front of the baronial residence was Rufino, and so on Mr. Aristotle's advice, Faustina had him summoned as a witness. On Tuesday morning, before court, Rufino came to Mr. Aristotle. "What story am I to tell today?" he asked. "The truth," Mr. Aristotle replied. "That's all right," said Rufino. "I'll swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, but after that, what am I supposed to say?" "After that," Mr. Aristotle was firm, "you will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth." Rufino was beginning to be afraid. He had told lies many times. He had told them every time he had ever testified before the judge. But this was the first time he had ever been instructed to tell the truth. No wonder he was afraid. As he faced the judge, Rufino shook like a leaf. He took oath in an unsteady voice and then went on to describe what had happened in front of the Baron's residence, being specific as to the Baron's having set the dogs on Faustina. The Baron himself was not present in court, but the room was packed with his dependents, who filed before the judge one by one to contradict flatly Rufino's testimony. But it was Toto who clinched with matter. "Is it true that your friend Rufino was in front of the Baron's residence?" the judge asked him. And Toto's answer was, "No." Rufino was at once placed under arrest for perjury, and a pair of police officers took him off to jail. He offered no resistance. He realized that he had made a mess of things, but his excuse was that he had been ill-advised by Mr. Aristotle. And so it was that the latter, through having yielded to a silly sentimental impulse, lost his job with the municipality and with the lawyer, and was reduced to living on the brink of purgatory, between the peasants whom he despised and the landed gentry whom he loathed. Mr. Aristotle still writes a fine hand, but his epistolary style is a trifle antiquated, which is one reason why the young folks now resort to him only in the gravest emergencies. The peasants ordinarily used to fall in love in church in winter time. In front of the church, before or after Mass, the young fellows would lie in wait for the girls to snowball them. To hit a girl with a snowball was the first way of letting her know that you were interested in her. After church came the fountain. In the evening, before the Hail Mary, all the girls would come out of the house with a copper pail to go to the public fountain for a supply of water. On the way down, they dangled the pails from their arms, but coming back, they carried them on their heads like antique water jugs. And all along the way, coming and going, each peasant lad would follow, ardent-eyed, but at a respectful distance, the object of his affections. After the fountain, especially if the girl, by a smile or two, had shown that the young man's suit was not displeasing to her, there would come a letter written by Mr. Aristotle. "This ritual was once unvarying," Mr. Aristotle says to me. "First came the church, then the fountain, then the letter. If the letter met with an encouraging response, there was a serenade under the window. Very little of it all is left now. And what is the life of man without a ritual? A drab thing, indeed. But this is only one instance. Many another of the old ceremonious forms has gone by the board. Human relations have become crude and unadorned with any niceties." Human relations, I venture at this point, have become more straightforward and direct. Between men and women, between rich and poor, they may be harsher, but they are at least more straightforward. If the priest, the public letter writer, the witch, and the fortune teller suffer from it, it is all the better. "All the better for the revolution is what you mean," Mr. Aristotle replied, "but not for the public welfare. The public welfare calls for ceremonies. To keep man bound to woman and peasant to his master, the priest, the public letter writer, witches, and fortune tellers are indispensable. I am well aware that they have tried to replace all these things with other means, but those means have proved unsatisfactory. The new government has not been able to create a new ritual acceptable to the masses, as a substitute for that old one of ours which has fallen into decay. The only thing left is force, but force without ritual cannot last very long." Mr. Aristotle is an avowed enemy of universal and compulsory education. Only a minority should be able to read and write. He speaks with loathing of our present civilization, in which all are capable of wielding a pen, and thinks back longingly to that golden age when the majority of the population was illiterate. For the importance of the public letter writer was never greater than then. That individual was everybody's private secretary, and clients stood in line in front of his desk. "The saddest part of all," says Mr. Aristotle, "is that they try to justify the thing in the name of progress. What do they mean by progress? We haven't gone forward, we've gone backward. All you have to do is read a love letter written today by the party concerned and compare it with one written in the old days by the public letter writer. You hear a lot of talk about the families not being what it used to be and about the decrease in the number of marriages, but they don't dare go to the bottom of the matter and look for the root of the evil. The real root of the evil is the idiotic habit that the majority of women today have of trying to write their own love letters. It is not that women nowadays are any more stupid than they ever were. They've always been silly, but at least in the old days they didn't know how to read and write, and so had to come to the public letter writer, who, with his education and knowledge of life, could turn out an epistle that would stir the hardest-hearted man alive, which could patch up a broken engagement and create in the man the illusion that the woman of his choice was not a simpleton, as she was in reality, but the most refined of beings, at once cultivated and burning with passion. And you mean to tell me that marriage didn't come as a disillusionment? Never, Mr. Aristotle insists, never. For it wasn't only the girl, you know, who came to the public letter writer. The prospective bridegroom came also, and it was often one and the same letter writer who served the two of them, who inspired in each of them, in turn, sentiments of whose existence they had not before been aware, in the guise of poetry and romance. The handwriting would have indicated that the letters on each side had been composed by the same person, but human beings like nothing better than to be deceived. And furthermore, you must remember that the public letter writer was also a public letter reader, and was used to having brought to him by the recipient the missives which he himself had indited, which gave him a chance to compute the effect in the way of sighs and tears which his eloquence had had. Knowing thus the two correspondents, being in their confidence and acquainted with their innermost desires, their tastes and longings, it was not hard for him to draw even tighter a bond which in the beginning had seemed a wavering one, and to bring the couple to the point of matrimony. Mr. Aristotle loved to tell of the hundreds of amorous barks which he had steered safely into harbor, for even after it had put him out of office, the public did not disdain to come to him with its private troubles. But don't you think, Mr. Aristotle, that letters are more sincere when they are written by the party concerned, and that the girl who knows how to write is better able to express her feelings than a public letter writer who is getting along in years? Don't talk nonsense, exclaimed Mr. Aristotle. If the girl came to the public letter writer, it was not only because she didn't know how to write, but also because she didn't know what to say, because she was inexperienced and ignorant in affairs of the heart. A girl would come and say, "Mr. Aristotle, I want you to write a very passionate letter for me." Those are all the instructions she would give me. "Passionate in what way?" I would ask. "Well, if you don't know," she'd answer, "how do you expect me to?" No, don't think for a minute that the public letter writer simply took dictation. That rarely happened. Usually the party would provide him with the general theme and leave it to him to develop. Something like this, for example. A young man has just proposed to me. I don't want to say yes right away, for that wouldn't be nice. I just want to say enough to let him know that if he keeps on, his chances are good. And with this as a theme, the letter writer would turn out 4 pages with numerous asterisks. Naturally, in the days when he had a host of clients, Mr. Aristotle did not greatly rack his brain in thinking up new phrases for each occasion. He had, so to speak, a permanent repertory of them. The only thing that was personal and individual in a letter had to do with the color of the loved one's eyes, her hair, the amplitude of her bosom, or similar anatomical details, but the rest was pretty much the same. The consequence was, a letter sometimes had an annoyingly familiar ring, as when a man received a passionate communication which was worded the same as those he had had from a number of previous sweethearts. But he seldom noticed it, Mr. Aristotle commented. Love is blind, you know. The truth is, Mr. Aristotle has not been able to adapt himself to the new tenor of relationship between men and women. He knows very little about the new forms that have come in, and accordingly, if anyone still comes to him for aid and advice, the old letter writer continues to be governed by the code of former years. Liberato Boccella, the butcher, is a case in point. Boccella, the butcher, had been eyeing the notary's daughter. He was quite smitten with her. "Be sure and wait for her outside the church," Mr. Aristotle advised him, "and then follow her when she goes to the fountain." "But she doesn't go to the fountain. They have water in the house at the notary," said Boccella mournfully. "Water in the house?" Mr. Aristotle was taken unawares. At this moment the notary's daughter went past. "How do you do, miss?" said the butcher. "Nice day for a walk." She looked at him contemptuously without answering. A short while later she came back with a girlfriend. The notary's daughter carried daisies in her hand and did not so much as glance in the direction of the butcher shop. "Did you see that?" Mr. Aristotle was quick to note. "It's plain that she's in love with you. Daisies mean be persevering and have faith in me." Mr. Aristotle was thoroughly versed in the language of flowers. "The sunflower means, even though you change, I'm true to you. White gillyflowers mean, I'm waiting for a letter. White lilacs, I can't sleep on account of you. Yellow gillyflowers, there's a jealous woman who pretends to be a friend, but who would like to part us. The red rose, without you I cannot go on living. But daisies mean only one thing, be persevering and have faith in me." Poor Boccella was beside himself with joy and made Mr. Aristotle a present of a soup bone. A butcher is always a good client to have. "What shall I do now?" Boccella asked. "Keep some jasmines within arm's reach," Mr. Aristotle advised him, "and the next time you see her, put them to your lips. In the language of flowers, that means, very well, I will persevere and have faith in you." It would have been impossible to find more expert counsel. Every time the notary's daughter went out for a stroll, there was the butcher with a bunch of jasmines at his mouth. The girl would look the other way. Only once she stared him straight in the face. "You big silly," she said with a laugh. On her way home, she had a bouquet of violets. Boccella at once ran to tell Mr. Aristotle. A butcher client's always a good one to have, and the old letter writer did not mean to let this one slip through his fingers. "It's as plain as day," said Mr. Aristotle. "In the language of flowers, a cluster of violets means, don't look at appearances, look at my heart." It was decided to draw up a letter. Mr. Aristotle labored at it one whole day and filled 8 pages. It was a touching epistle. Mr. Aristotle was proud of it. If a cow could read, he assured the butcher, it would bring tears to her eyes. The notary's daughter, however, was not a cow, for that very day there came back a letter containing only these words, "Stop being so stupid and leave me in peace." It was a terrible blow for poor Boccella, but not for Mr. Aristotle. "Take a good look at the envelope," he urged. "A stamp turned upside down in sign language always means, don't believe what's in this letter, but just the contrary. She probably had to write that way on account of her father, but in putting the stamp on, she tried to warn you not to believe what the letter says." The butcher was greatly pleased with this explanation and presented Mr. Aristotle with a big soup bone this time. By way of reply to the loved one's note, a plain postal card was dispatched with the stamp pasted sidewise, the head to the right. "In sign language," Mr. Aristotle expounded, "that means I understand perfectly." It was then decided to give a serenade under the windows of the notary's house. The butcher put on a new suit for the occasion. The barber, who played the guitar very well, was engaged to furnish the music, and Mr. Aristotle, although he was a little hoarse, was to do the singing. At midnight, the trio appeared at the notary's, and to the guitar accompaniment, Mr. Aristotle began, "It's 30 days that I care for you. It's 30 nights that I cannot sleep." A second-floor window opened, and Mr. Aristotle and the barber fell back a short distance to leave the butcher alone with his inamorata. Through the window came a man's arm and a huge thunder mug. The thunder mug was inverted, and the butcher found himself drenched with urine. The poor fellow thought of that brand-new suit of his, but his grief over this was as nothing to the sudden anger he felt toward Mr. Aristotle. "It's all your fault!" he shouted. "You tricked and wheedled me just for what you could get out of me!" "Silence!" said Mr. Aristotle and raised a hand. Coming up to the butcher, he sniffed all around him for a minute or two. "Cheer up," he finally said. "It's hers." Mr. Aristotle motioned to the barber. The latter now approached and in turn did some prolonged sniffing about the butcher's drenched garments. "That's the truth," he announced. "You can believe me on my word of honor, it's hers." "But how do you know that?" asked the butcher. "It's something you can't explain," the pair between them replied. "It's a matter of sense and scent. You either get it or you don't." The episode just related goes to show that Mr. Aristotle's erudition is of no great service in this age of ours. All the old ritual has been lost. Men and women have learned to read and write, but they are none the happier for it, according to him. One of the evils resulting from popular education, he observes, is the alarming increase in the number of suicides. You hear a great deal of discussion of this subject, and the explanation given is invariably a trite and stupid one. No one has stopped to compare the proportion of those who are able to read and write with the number who commit suicide. They will tell you that, if there are more suicides, it is on account of the greater poverty today. But there's always been poverty in the world. There are many who are poor, and yet they don't kill themselves. Stop and think a minute. What is the one thing that every suicide does? He writes letters, always without fail. Every person who commits suicide writes a letter to the mother, sweetheart, the chief of police, his creditors, etc. The simplest bit of logic will show that if he couldn't write a letter, he wouldn't commit suicide. I glanced at Mr. Aristotle in surprise. What are you getting at? Just this, he says. A system of society that cannot assure the well-being of all has no business popularizing education. If it weren't for education, poverty would be endurable. It has lasted for centuries, and men were able to bear it. But with education extended to all, no one wants to go hungry any longer. The weak commit suicide. The others... Mr. Aristotle breaks off. An old woman from Newtown has need of his services. She's the only client he has had today. "Mr. Aristotle," the old woman is saying, "I want you to write an anonymous letter for me. I want the one who gets it to cry with rage for 24 hours. 24 hours, Mr. Aristotle repeats. "Why not 12? "No," replies the old woman, "it must be 24. And so tomorrow in Newtown, for 24 hours, someone will weep and wait and gnash his teeth. And that story was Mr. Aristotle by Ignazio Saloni, from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is also from Great Short Stories of the Masters, The Hungry Stones by Rabindranath Tagore. My kinsman and myself were returning to Calcutta from our puja trip when we met the man in a train. From his dress and bearing, we took him at first for an upcountry Mohammedan, but we were puzzled as we heard him talk. He discoursed upon all subjects so confidently that you might think the disposer of all things consulted him at all times in all that he did. Hitherto we had been perfectly happy, as we did not know that secret and unheard-of forces were at work, that the Russians had advanced close to us, that the English had deep and secret policies, that confusion among the native chiefs had come to a head. But our newly acquired friend said with a sly smile, "There happen more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are reported in your newspapers." As we had never stirred out of our homes before, the demeanor of the man struck us dumb with wonder. Be the topic ever so trivial, he would quote science, or comment on the Vedas, or repeat quatrains from some Persian poet, and as we had no pretense to a knowledge of science or the Vedas or Persian, our admiration for him went on increasing, and my kinsman, a theosophist, was firmly convinced that our fellow passenger must have been supernaturally inspired by some strange magnetism or occult power, by an astral body, or something of that kind. He listened to the tritest saying that fell from the lips of our extraordinary companion with devotional rapture, and secretly took down notes of his conversation. I fancy that the extraordinary man saw this and was a little pleased with it. When the train reached the junction, we assembled in the waiting room for the connection. It was then 10 p.m., and as the train, we heard, was likely to be very late, owing to something wrong in the lines, I spread my bed on the table and was about to lie down for a comfortable doze, when the extraordinary person deliberately set about spinning the following yarn. Of course I could get no sleep that night. when, owing to a disagreement about some questions of an administrative policy, I threw up my post at Junagadh and entered the service of Nizam of Hyderabad. They appointed me at once as a strong young man, collector of cotton duties at Berwick. Berwick is a lovely place. The Susta chatters over stony ways and babbles on the pebbles, tripping like a skillful dancing girl in through the woods below the lonely hills. A flight of 150 steps rises from the river, and above that flight, on the river's brim and at the foot of the hills, there stands a solitary marble palace. Around it there's no habitation of man, the village and the cotton mark of Berwick being far off. About 250 years ago, the Emperor Mahmud Shah II had built this lonely palace for his pleasure and luxury. In his days, jets of rose water spurted from its fountains, and on the cold marble floors of its spray-cooled rooms, young Persian damsels would sit, their hair disheveled before bathing, and splashing their soft naked feet in the clear water of the reservoirs, would sing, to the tune of the guitar, the ghazals of their vineyards. The fountains play no longer, the songs have ceased, no longer do snow-white feet step gracefully on the snowy marble. It is but the vast and solitary quarters of cess collectors like us, men oppressed with solitude and deprived of the society of women. Now Karim Khan, the old clerk at my office, warned me repeatedly not to take up my abode there. "Pass the day there if you like," said he, "but never stay the night." I passed it off with a light laugh. The servants said that they would work till dark and go away at night. I gave my ready assent. The house had such a bad name that even thieves would not venture near it after dark. At first the solitude of the deserted palace weighed upon me like a nightmare. I would stay out and work hard as long as possible, then return home at night jaded and tired, go to bed and fall asleep. Before a week had passed, the place began to exert a weird fascination upon me. It is difficult to describe or to induce people to believe, but I felt as if the whole house was like a living organism, slowly and imperceptibly digesting me by the action of some stupefying gastric juice. Perhaps the process had begun as soon as I set my foot in the house, but I distinctly remember the day on which I first was conscious of it. It was the beginning of summer, and the market being dull, I had no work to do. A little before sunset I was sitting in an armchair near the water's edge below the steps. The Susta had shrunk and sunk low. A broad patch of sand on the other side glowed with the hues of evening. On this side the pebbles at the bottom of the clear, shallow waters were glistening. There was not a breath of wind anywhere, and the still air was laden with an oppressive scent from the spicy shrubs growing on the hills close by. As the sun sank behind the hilltops, a long dark curtain fell upon the stage of day, and the intervening hills cut short the time in which light and shade mingle at sunset. I thought of going out for a ride, and was about to get up when I heard a footfall on the steps behind. I looked back, but there was no one. As I sat down again, thinking it to be an illusion, I heard many footfalls, as if a large number of persons were rushing down the steps. A strange thrill of delight, slightly tinged with fear, passed through my frame, and though there was not a figure before my eyes, methought I saw a bevy of joyous maidens coming down the steps to bathe in the Susta in that summer evening. Not a sound was in the valley, in the river, or in the palace, to break the silence, but I distinctly heard the maidens' gay and mirthful laugh, like the gurgle of a spring gushing forth in a hundred cascades, as they ran past me, in quick, playful pursuit of each other, towards the river, without noticing me at all. As they were invisible to me, so I was, as it were, invisible to them. The river was perfectly calm, but I felt that its still, shallow, and clear waters were stirred suddenly by the splash of many an arm jingling with bracelets, that the girls laughed and dashed in spattered water at one another, that the feet of the fair swimmers tossed the tiny waves up in showers of pearl. I felt a thrill at my heart. I cannot say whether the excitement was due to fear or delight or curiosity. I had a strong desire to see them more clearly, but naught was visible before me. I thought I could catch all that they said if only I strained my ears, but however hard I strained them, I heard nothing but the chirping of the cicadas in the woods. It seemed as if a dark curtain of 250 years was hanging before me, and I would fain lift a corner of it tremblingly and peer through, though the assembly on the other side was completely enveloped in darkness. The oppressive closeness of the evening was broken by a sudden gust of wind, and the still surface of the Susta rippled and curled like the hair of a nymph, and from the woods, wrapped in the evening gloom, there came forth a simultaneous murmur, as though they were awakening from a black dream. Call it reality or dream, the momentary glimpse of that invisible mirage reflected from a far-off world, 250 years old, vanished in a flash. The mystic forms that brushed past me with their quick, unbodied steps and loud, voiceless laughter, and threw themselves into the river, did not go back, wringing their dripping robes as they went. Like fragrance wafted away by the wind, they were dispersed by a single breath of the spring. Then I was filled with a lively fear that it was a muse that had taken advantage of my solitude and possessed me. The witch had evidently come to ruin a poor devil like myself, making a living by collecting cotton duties. I decided to have a good dinner. It is the empty stomach that all sorts of incurable diseases find an easy prey. I sent for my cook and gave orders for a rich, sumptuous Mogali dinner, redolent of spices and ghee. Next morning, the whole affair appeared a queer fantasy. With a light heart, I put on a sola hat like the sahib's and drove out to my work. I was to have written my quarterly report that day and expected to return late. But before it was dark, I was strangely drawn to my house. By what I could not say, I felt they were all waiting and that I should delay no longer. Leaving my report unfinished, I rose, put on my sola hat, and startling the dark, shady, desolate path with the rattle of my carriage, I reached the vast, silent palace standing on the gloomy skirts of the hills. On the first floor, the stairs led to a very spacious hall, its roof stretching wide over ornamental arches resting on three rows of massive pillars, and groaning day and night under the weight of its own intense solitude. The day had just closed, and the lamps had not yet been lighted. As I pushed the door open, a great bustle seemed to follow within, as if a throng of people had broken up in confusion and rushed out through the doors and windows and corridors and verandas and rooms to make its hurried escape. As I saw no one, I stood bewildered, my hair on end in a kind of ecstatic delight, and a faint scent of attar and unguents, almost effaced by age, lingered in my nostrils. Standing in the darkness of that vast, desolate hall between the rows of these ancient pillars, I could hear the gurgle of fountains plashing on the marble floor, a strange tune on the guitar, the jingle of ornaments and the tinkle of anklets, the clang of bells tolling the hours, the distant note of Nahabat, the din of the crystal pendants of chandeliers shaken by the breeze, the song of bulbuls from the cages in the corridors, the cackle of storks in the gardens, all creating round me a strange, unearthly music. Then I came under such a spell that this intangible, inaccessible, unearthly vision appeared to be the only reality in the world, and all else a mere dream. That I, that is to say, Srijit so-and-so, the eldest son of so-and-so, a blessed memory, should be drawing a monthly salary of 450 rupees by the discharge of my duties as collector of cotton duties, and driving in my dog-cart to my office every day in a short coat and sola hat appeared to me to be such an astonishingly ludicrous illusion that I burst into a hoarse laugh as I stood in the gloom of that vast silent hall. At that moment my servant entered with a lighted kerosene lamp in his hand. I do not know whether he thought me mad, but it came back to me at once that I was in very deed Srijit so-and-so, son of so-and-so of blessed memory, and that while our poets, great and small, alone could say whether inside or outside the earth there was a region where unseen fountains perpetually played, and fairy guitars, struck by invisible fingers, sent forth an eternal harmony, this at any rate was certain, that I collected duties at the cotton market at Barrick, and earned thereby 450 rupees per mensum as my salary. I laughed in great glee at my curious illusion, as I sat over the newspaper at my camp table, lighted by the kerosene lamp. After I'd finished my paper and eaten my Mogali dinner, I put out the lamp and lay down on my bed in a small side room. Through the open window, a radiant star, high above the Avali hills, skirted by the darkness of their woods, was gazing intently from millions and millions of miles away in the sky at Mr. Collector lying on a humble camp bedstead. I wondered and felt amused at the idea, and do not know when I fell asleep or how long I slept, but I suddenly awoke with a start, though I heard no sound and saw no intruder. Only the steady bright star in the hilltop had set, and the dim light of the new moon was stealthily entering the room through the open window, as if ashamed of its intrusion. I saw nobody, but felt as if someone was gently pushing me. As I woke, she said not a word, but beckoned me with her five fingers, bedecked with rings, to follow her cautiously. I got up noiselessly, and though not a soul save myself was there in the countless apartments of that deserted palace with its slumbering sounds and waking echoes, I feared at every step lest anyone should wake up. Most of the rooms of the palace were always kept closed, and I had never entered them. I followed breathless and with silent steps my invisible guide. I cannot now say where. What endless dark and narrow passages, what long corridors, what silent and solemn audience chambers and close secret cells I crossed. Though I could not see my fair guide, her form was not invisible to my mind's eye. An Arab girl, her arms, hard and smooth as marble, visible through her loose sleeves, a thin veil falling on her face from the fringe of her cap, and a curved dagger at her waist. Methought that one of the 1001 Arabian Nights had been wafted to me from the world of romance, and that at the dead of night I was wending my way through the dark narrow alleys of slumbering Baghdad to a trysting place fraught with peril. At last my fair guide stopped abruptly before a deep blue screen and seemed to point to something below. There was nothing there, but a sudden dread froze the blood in my heart. Methought I saw there on the floor at the foot of the screen a terrible negro eunuch dressed in rich brocade, sitting and dozing with outstretched legs, with a naked sword on his lap. My fair guide lightly tripped over his legs and held up a fringe of the screen. I could catch a glimpse of a part of the room spread with a Persian carpet. Someone was sitting inside on a bed. I could not see her, but only caught a glimpse of two exquisite feet in gold-embroidered slippers hanging out from loose saffron-colored pajamas and placed idly on the orange-colored velvet carpet. On one side there was a bluish crystal tray on which a few apples, pears, oranges, and bunches of grapes in plenty, two small cups and a gold-tinted decanter were evidently awaiting the guest. A fragrant, intoxicating vapor, issuing from a strange sort of incense that burned within, almost overpowered my senses. As with trembling heart I made an attempt to step across the outstretched legs of the eunuch, he woke up suddenly with a start, and the sword fell from his lap with a sharp clang on the marble floor. A terrific scream made me jump, and I saw I was sitting on that camp bedstead of mine, sweating heavily, and the crescent moon looked pale in the morning light like a weary, sleepless patient at dawn, and our crazy mayor Ali was crying out, as is his daily custom, "Stand back! Stand back!" while he went along the lonely road. Such was the abrupt close of one of my Arabian nights, but there were yet 1,000 nights left. Then followed a great discord between my days and nights. During the day I would go to my work, worn and tired, cursing the bewitching night and her empty dreams. But as night came, my daily life with its bonds and shackles of work would appear a petty, false, ludicrous vanity. After nightfall I was caught and overwhelmed in the snare of a strange intoxication. I would then be transformed into some unknown personage of a bygone age, playing my part in unwritten history, and my short English coat and tight breeches did not suit me in the least. With a red velvet cap on my head, loose pajamas, an embroidered vest, a long flowing silk gown, and colored handkerchiefs scented with attar, I would complete my elaborate toilet, sit on a high cushioned chair, and replace my cigarette with a many-coiled narghileh filled with rose water, as if in eager expectation of a strange meeting with the beloved one. I have no power to describe the marvelous incidents that unfolded themselves as the gloom of the night deepened. I felt as if in the curious apartments of that vast edifice the fragments of a beautiful story, which I could follow for some distance, but of which I could never see the end, flew about in a sudden gust of the vernal breeze. And all the same I would wander from room to room in pursuit of them the whole night long. Amid the eddy of these dream fragments, amid the smell of henna and the twanging of the guitar, amid the waves of air charged with fragrant spray, I would catch like a flash of lightning the momentary glimpse of a fair damsel. She it was who had saffron-colored pajamas, white ruddy soft feet and gold-embroidered slippers with curved toes, a close-fitting bodice wrought with gold, red cap from which a golden frill fell on her snowy brow and cheeks. She had maddened me. In pursuit of her I wandered from room to room, from path to path, among the bewildering maze of alleys, in the enchanted dreamland of the nether world of sleep. Sometimes in the evening, while arraying myself carefully as a prince of the blood royal before a large mirror, with a candle burning on either side, I would see a sudden reflection of the Persian beauty by the side of my own. A swift turn of her neck, a quick, eager glance of intense passion and pain glowing in her large, dark eyes, just a suspicion of speech on her dainty red lips, her figure, fair and slim, crowned with youth like a blossoming creeper, quickly uplifted in her graceful tilting gait, a dazzling flash of pain and craving and ecstasy, a smile and a glance and a blaze of jewels and silk, and she melted away. A wild gust of wind, laden with all the fragrance of hills and woods, would put out my light, and I would fling aside my dress and lie down on my bed, my eyes closed and my body thrilling with delight, and there around me in the breeze, amid all the perfume of the woods and hills, floated through the silent gloom many a caress and many a kiss and many a tender touch of hands, and gentle murmurs in my ears and fragrant breaths on my brow, or a sweetly perfumed kerchief was wafted again and again on my cheeks. Then slowly a mysterious serpent would twist her stupefying coils about me, and heaving a heavy sigh, I would lapse into insensibility, and then into a profound slumber. One evening I decided to go out on my horse. I do not know who implored me to stay, but I would listen to no entreaties that day. My English hat and coat were resting on a rack, and I was about to take them down when a sudden whirlwind crested with the sands of the Susta and the dead leaves of the Avali hills, caught them up and whirled them round and round, while a loud peal of merry laughter rose higher and higher, striking all the chords of mirth till it died away in the land of sunset. I could not go out for my ride, and the next day I gave up my queer English coat and hat for good. That day again, at dead of night, I heard the stifled heart-breaking sobs of someone, as if below the bed, below the floor, below the stony foundation of thy gigantic palace, from the depths of a dark, damp grave, a voice piteously cried and implored me, "Oh, rescue me! Break through these doors of hard illusion, death-like slumber and fruitless dreams. Place me by your side on the saddle, press me to your heart, and riding through hills and woods and across the river, take me to the warm radiance of your sunny rooms above." "Who am I? How can I rescue thee? What drowning beauty, what incarnate passion shall I drag to the shore from this wild eddy of dreams? O lovely ethereal apparition, where didst thou flourish and when? By what cool spring, under the shade of what date groves, wast thou born? In the lap of what homeless wanderer in the desert? What Bedouin snatched thee from thy mother's arms, an opening bud plucked from a wild creeper, placed thee on a horse swift as lightning, crossed the burning sands, and took thee to the slave market of what royal city? And there what officer of the Badshah, seeing the glory of thy bashful blossoming youth, paid for thee in gold, placed thee in a golden palanquin, and offered thee as a present for the seraglio of his master? And oh, the history of that place, the music of the sarang, the jingle of anklets, the occasional flash of daggers, and the glowing wine of Shiraz poison, and the piercing, flashing glance. What infinite grandeur, what endless servitude! The slave girls to thy right and left wave the chamar as diamonds flash from their bracelets. The Badshah, the king of kings, fell on his knees at thy snowy feet in bejeweled shoes, and outside the terrible Abyssinian eunuch, looking like a messenger of death, but clothed like an angel, stood with a naked sword in his hand. Then, O flower of the desert, swept away by the blood-stained, dazzling ocean of grandeur, with its foam of jealousy, its rocks and shoals of intrigue, on what shore of cruel death wast thou cast, or in what other land more splendid and more cruel? Suddenly at this moment that crazy mare Ali screamed out, "Stand back! Stand back! All is false! All is false!" I opened my eyes and saw that it was already light. My chaprasi came and handed me my letters, and the cook waited with a salaam for my orders. I said, "No, I can stay here no longer." That very day I packed up and moved to my office. Old Karim Khan smiled a little as he saw me. I felt nettled, but said nothing, and fell to my work. As evening approached, I grew absent-minded. I felt as if I had an appointment to keep, and the work of examining the cotton account seemed wholly useless. Even the nizamat of the nizam did not appear to be of much worth. Whatever belonged to the present, whatever was moving and acting and working for bread, seemed trivial, meaningless, and contemptible. I threw my pen down, closed my ledgers, got into my dog cart, and drove away. I noticed that it stopped of itself at the gate of the marble palace just at the hour of twilight. With quick steps I climbed the stairs and entered the room. A heavy silence was reigning within. The dark rooms were looking sullen as if they had taken offense. My heart was full of contrition, but there was no one to whom I could lay it bare, or of whom I could ask forgiveness. I wandered about the dark rooms with a vacant mind. I wished I had a guitar to which I could sing to the unknown. O fire, the poor moth that made a vain effort to fly away has come back to thee. Forgive it but this once, burn its wings, and consume it in thy flame. Suddenly two teardrops fell from overhead on my brow. Dark masses of clouds overcast the top of the Avali hills that day. The gloomy woods and the sooty waters of the Susta were waiting in terrible suspense and in an ominous calm. Suddenly land, water, and sky shivered, and a wild tempest blast rushed howling through the distant pathless woods, showing its lightning teeth like a raving maniac who had broken his chains. The desolate halls of the palace banged their doors and moaned in the bitterness of anguish. The servants were all in the office, and there was no one to light the lamps. The night was cloudy and moonless. In the desert gloom within, I could distinctly feel that a woman was lying on her face on the carpet below the bed, clasping and tearing her long disheveled hair with desperate fingers. Blood was trickling down her fair brow, and she was now laughing a hard, harsh, mirthless laugh, now bursting into violent, ringing sobs, now rending her bodice and striking at her bare bosom, as the wind roared in through the open window, and the rain poured in torrents and soaked her through and through. All night there was no cessation of the storm or of the passionate cry. I wandered from room to room in the dark with unavailing sorrow. Whom could I console when no one was by? Whose was this intense agony of sorrow? Whence arose this inconsolable grief? And the madman cried out, "Stand back! Stand back! All is false! All is false!" I saw that the day had dawned and Mayor Ali was going round and round the palace with his usual cry in that dreadful weather. Suddenly it came to me that perhaps he also had once lived in that house, and that though he had gone mad, he came there every day and went round and round, fascinated by the weird spell cast by the marble demon. Despite the storm and rain, I ran to him and asked, "Ho, Mayor Ali, what is false?" The man answered nothing, but pushing me aside went round and round with his frantic cry, like a bird flying fascinated about the jaws of a snake, and made a desperate effort to warn himself by repeating, "Stand back! Stand back! All is false! All is false!" I ran like a madman through the pelting rain to my office and asked Karim Khan, "Tell me the meaning of all this." What I gathered from that old man was this: that at one time countless unrequited passions and unsatisfied longings and lurid flames of wild blazing pleasure raged within that palace, and that the curse of all the heartaches and blasted hopes had made its every stone thirsty and hungry, eager to swallow up like a famished ogress any living man who might chance to approach. Not one of those who lived there for three consecutive nights could escape these cruel jaws, save Mayor Ali, who had escaped at the cost of his reason. I asked, "Is there no means whatever of my release?" The old man said, "There's only one means, and that is very difficult. I will tell you what it is, but first you must hear the history of a young Persian girl who once lived in that pleasure dome. A stranger or more bitterly heart-rending tragedy was never enacted on this earth." Just at this moment the coolies announced that the train was coming. "So soon?" We hurriedly packed up our luggage as the train steamed in. An English gentleman, apparently just aroused from slumber, was looking out of a first-class carriage, endeavoring to read the name of the station. As soon as he caught sight of our fellow passenger, he cried, "Hello!" and took him into his own compartment. As we got into a second-class carriage, we had no chance of finding out who the man was, nor what was the end of the story. I said, "The man evidently took us for fools and imposed upon us out of fun. The story is pure fabrication from start to finish." The discussion that followed ended in a lifelong rupture between my theosophist kinsman and myself. And that story was The Hungry Stones by Rabindranath Tagore, from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The next story is also from Great Short Stories of the Masters, Twilight by Władysław Stanisław Raymond. Sokol lay dying. He had been lying this way a long time. He had fallen sick and was now kicked about like a useless carcass. Good people said it would be wrong to kill him, even though his handsome hide would make fine leather. Yes, good people let him die slowly, alone and forgotten. The same good souls rewarded him occasionally with a kick to remind him that he was dying too slowly. But they took no other notice of him. Once in a while the hunting dogs, with whom he used to leap in the chase, came to visit him. But dogs have ugly souls, from too much contact with human beings. And at every call of their masters they left Sokol precipitously. Only Lapa, an old blind Siberian hound, stayed with him longer than the others. He lay dozing under the feed trough, oppressed with sorrow at the sight of Sokol, whose large, pleading, tearful eyes frightened him. So the old horse was left to his solitary misery. The days kept him company, golden, rosy days, or gray and harsh and painful ones, filling the stall with their weeping. They peered into his eyes and silently departed, as if awe-stricken. But Sokol was afraid only of the nights, the short, fearful, silent, stifling nights of June. It was then that he felt he was surely dying, and he became almost frantic with terror. He would tear at his halter and beat with his hoofs against the wall. He wanted to escape, to run and run. One day, as the sun was setting, he jumped up, stared at the flecks of light that filtered in through the cracks of the walls, and began to neigh long and plaintively. Not a single voice answered him from the close, heavy stillness of the departing day. Swallows flitted by, or chirped from their nests, or darted like feathered arrows among the golden insects that buzzed in the sun's last rays. From the distant meadows was heard the sharp ringing and swishing of busy scythes, and from the fields of grain and flowers came a rustling and humming and whispering. But about Sokol there was a deep, awful silence that made him shiver. Somber panic seized him, and he began to tug frenziedly at his halter. It broke, and he fled into the yard. The sun blinded him, and a wild pain gnawed at his entrails. He lowered his head and stood motionless, as if stunned. Little by little, however, he came to himself again. Dim memories of fields, forests, meadows floated through his brain. There awoke in him a resistless desire to run, a longing to conquer vast distances, a craving thirst to live again. He began to seek eagerly for an exit from the yard. It was a square yard, three sides of which were shut in by various buildings. He searched in vain. He tried again and again, though he could barely stand on his legs, though every movement caused him indescribable pain, though the blood kept flowing from his old sores. At last he struck a wooden fence from which he could see the manor house. He gazed at the flower-covered lawn before it, where dogs were basking, at the house itself with its windows glittering golden in the sun, and began to neigh pleadingly, piteously. If anyone had come and said a kind word to him or smoothed his coat caressingly, he would willingly have laid down and died. But all about was deserted, drowsy, still. In despair he began to bite the rails and wrench the gate, leaning against it with all his weight. It burst open, and he walked into the garden. He approached the veranda, still neighing plaintively, but no one heard him. He stood there a long time, gazing at the curtained windows, and even tried to climb up the steps. Then he walked all around the house. Suddenly he seemed to forget everything. He saw only visions of vast grain fields, as limitless as the sea, stretching away to a distant, endlessly distant horizon. Bewitched by these alluring fancies, he began to stagger and stumble forward with all his waning might. Sokol shivered. His eyes grew glazed with suffering. He breathed heavily and nosed the damp grass to cool his heated nostrils. He was very thirsty, but he kept staggering onward, impelled by a somber panic and resistless impulse to escape. As he stumbled among the stalks of wheat and corn, his feet grew heavier and heavier. The furrows were like pitfalls. The grass entangled his feet and dragged him down. The bushes barred his path. The whole earth seemed to pull him eagerly toward itself. Often the grain hid the horizon from his gaze. His poor dumb soul sank deeper and deeper into the darkness of terror. Recognizing nothing, he kept staggering blindly forward as in a fog. A partridge leading her brood flew up suddenly between his legs, causing him to start in fright and remain motionless, not daring to stir. Crows that flew silently across the field stopped on observing him and sat down on a pear tree, cawing and croaking evilly. He dragged himself into the meadow and sank exhausted to the ground. He stretched out his legs, looked up into the sky, and sighed piteously. The crows flew down from the trees and hopped along the ground nearer and nearer. The corn bent over and stared at him with its red poppy eyes. Still nearer came the crows, sharpening their beaks in the hard grass tufts. Some flew over him, cawing ravenously, lower and lower, till he saw their terrible round eyes and half-open beaks. But he could not stir. He struck his paws onto the ground and fancied he was up again, galloping across the field, in the chase, the hounds behind him barking, flying like the wind. His agony grew so intense that he gave one savage neigh and sprang to his feet. The crows flew away, screeching. But now he saw nothing, understood nothing. Everything wavered about him, spun, tossed, crashed. He felt himself sinking as in a deep mire. A cold shiver ran over his body, and he lay still. The sun sank. Obliterating twilight covered everything with a silent mantle. The barking of a dog grew audible in the distance. Lapa ran up to his friend, but Sokol did not recognize him. The old dog licked him, pawed at the ground, ran barking across the field hither and thither, calling for help, but no one came. The grass looked into Sokol's wide-open eyes. The trees approached him and reached out their sharp claw-like twigs to him. The birds grew still. Thousands of living things began to crawl over his body, to pinch and claw and rend his flesh. The crows cawed frightfully. Lapa, bristling with terror, moaned and howled weirdly. And that story was Twilight by Vladislav Stanislav Raymond from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.